Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Well, that happened. If you didn't catch the president's coronavirus briefing in real time, you probably need to go back because the sound bites just do not do it justice. I mean, I'm sure a lot of wacky things have taken place in the White House briefing room, but that was really something. So we thought we'd talk with somebody who knows all about the White House briefing room today. So our special guest is Joe Lockhart, who was a deputy press secretary and then press secretary to President Bill Clinton. So he has been there in that room or something like it. Joe, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Glad to be here.
You do your own podcast as well, right?
I do. I just finished it.
Okay. So what is it called?
It's called Words Matter. I do it with Katie Barlow, who's a lawyer. So we get into a lot of the legal / political stuff going on in D.C. Everyone has one now, but I think ours is pretty interesting.
Okay, but words, of course, don't matter because nothing matters anymore, right? Isn't that the problem? I mean, do you have these moments where you wake up and you go, "I tried so hard to just make sure I got it right." And then you turn on the news, and there's the president and his spokesman, I mean, just flinging it up against the wall. Don't you have those moments thinking, I wish I could have played by those rules?
You know, I do when I watch and I remember how hard it was, and I sort of joke that, if I could just make it up, I could have worked half days, had a better golf game, and more hair. The challenge is what makes the job fun, and the challenge of trying to, adhere to the public interest and the truth and, sort of some balky politicians who sometimes see things their own way, that's really, at the heart of why the job is hard, but also why the job is fun. I would not want to be one of these press people in the White House because they look very foolish every day.
Did you ever have a Sean Spicer moment, by which I mean that they tell you to say something that you know is complete bullshit, but they push you through the curtain and say, you got to go do this, and you have to go back to your office and go, I need something stronger than Diet Coke after doing that?
No. In fact, it's really kind of the opposite in my experience, and I know having talked to a lot of people who've had the job, but I can tell you about my experience with Bill Clinton. One of the things the press secretary has to do is anticipate the questions that they're going to get and what the president's going to get. So getting the president ready for, sitting in the Oval Office or a formal news conference required anywhere between 15 minutes of preparation or, 4 hours if it was a full-blown press conference. And you'd ask him hard questions and you'd ask them in a very kind of snarky, hard-edged way to get his initial response, which at times could be self-indulgent, at times could be incorrect because he doesn't have the right information, or self-serving and incorrect. And you'd really want him to get that out before he got to the press. So most often what would happen is the president would answer, and I would say something like, that's a really good answer, sir, but have you considered saying it this way? And he would see most times that there was a better way to do it and, sort of to take himself out of it. But I never had a situation where someone said to me, we know the sun came up in the east today, but for just today, you need to go sell it came up in the west. It just didn't happen. More often than not, what would happen is I'd want to explain something and people would say, well, you can't say those things. We're at a delicate moment of this negotiation or that could upset these people. So you'd go out and make an argument with an arm tied behind your back, but you never went out and purposefully didn't tell the truth.
So let's talk about what happened yesterday. We're recording this on Thursday about midday. The president named Mike Pence his sort of quasi-czar, non-czar coronavirus. But that was a rather extraordinary briefing by the president. So give me your take, what you saw, what you heard.
Well, you really had to have watched it to understand how bizarre it was and watched it in real time or watched the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Because if you pick up the paper today, you see, there was some news in it. Mike Pence is going to lead. As crazy it is that Mike Pence is going to lead a scientific process, put that aside because he doesn't believe in science. He believes in his faith as the answer to all questions. And you had Anthony Fauci, from NIH, and you had enough news nuggets in there that the stories kind of felt like it was a semi-normal press conference with a couple weird Trump quotes inserted. It was totally bizarre. The president clearly didn't know what he was talking about. And what he did is he must have had a couple of bullet points in front of him that they said, follow these. And he would accentuate each of the bullets with data, you know, that had data in them with his, like, rally language, like some people say. And, you know, at one point he said something like, the original 15 who contracted it, the original 15, as I call them, like, now we're going to give nicknames to coronavirus victims. It just, it was very, two things were very clear. One is he had no idea what he was talking about. And you knew that about 3 minutes in, that, you know, he hadn't taken the time to study or doesn't have the wherewithal to understand this stuff. And the second was that he was completely detached from the reality that we heard, you know, 25 minutes later from the experts. He kept, it was almost like in his mind, he was talking down the threat as he was going. He at one point said there's 15 cases, and then he said, but there's five, and now we're down to two, and we'll be at none. And this is, you know, it doesn't matter what the scientists say, this isn't inevitable. And it was almost like he felt like if he could talk himself into this not being a problem, he could talk the American public into it. But it was just, it is the single most bizarre thing I've ever seen in that room.
Yeah, it was bizarre. And you're right, there's kind of a flattening effect if you just read the headlines about what happened. You don't get a sense of how disconnected the president was, and also how strange the political environment is, where you have Rush Limbaugh and some of the other folks that the president listens to peddling these weird conspiracy theories. You know, that's one of the top health officials is married to Rod Rosenstein, and maybe this is a plot to weaponize this to bring down Donald Trump. And I was half wondering, you know, was he gonna do that himself? Because you know he's gonna pick it up sooner or later. I mean, if it comes out of Fox News or if it comes out of Rush Limbaugh, sooner or later, he's going to do it. By the way, before we go any further, we should mention you do a thing called the White House Daily Shadow Briefing. How long have you been doing this? It's on Twitter. It's a very detailed thing. So you're.
Yeah, I started doing it, I think, in May of last year. It had been, you know, they haven't done a briefing since last March. So we're coming up on a year. And, you know, people ask me, how long did you go without doing a briefing? And I said, sometimes I went 2 days without doing one, but never more than 2 days.
You stepped into the breach.
So I stepped into the breach, and I did it for a couple reasons. One is that there are a whole series of questions that the public has a right to pose to the government. And when I say the public, the press is the proxy. And they're not necessarily, not every one of them's on coronavirus. There are lots of things going on. And the questions in and of themselves should be surfaced. And by shutting down the briefing, they stopped that process. So I thought I should at least put the questions out there. And listen, I don't have a lot of expertise on things. I'm not a rocket scientist. I can't fix a car. I can tell you what reporters think are the questions of the day because I stood there and took them. And the reporters have generally a good sense of what's important and what isn't, you know, with some exceptions. You know, sometimes we go down rabbit holes. And then I thought, you know what? Wouldn't it be kind of fun or funny to answer the questions totally honestly and just say, yeah, the president made that speech because he has no idea what he's talking about, and just to go with it. And, you know, I never expected to still be doing this, you know, 10 months later. And, you know, it's become a slight albatross around my neck of I try to do it at least 3 times a week. I can't do it every day. But it's when I, in trying to say, oh, I need an hour to do this, I think, oh, I don't have that. But once I sit down to start doing it, I spend an hour kind of smiling and laughing to myself because it is, you know, it is pointing out the absurdity of the situation we're in, which is they won't take questions. And their answer to that is, well, the president takes questions, but the president lies almost every time he speaks. So it comes full circle. You know, and now what they do, which is, I think, kind of dangerous, is they have the press secretary go out every day on Fox. Mm-hmm. And everybody, because they don't have anything else, they use that. So I'll turn on CNN, I'll turn on MSNBC, and I'll see something from Fox. And, you know, in my brain, that's like, that was just laundered. You were just, yeah. You were had there. But you know, you can't win every fight.
So let me just looking at your feed from, from yesterday. This is like number six from your shadow briefing, that he demonstrated no understanding of the underlying issues, offered no guidance, information, or plan forward to deal with the issue. He did say things like, there are certain things happening and decisions I've made that were ridiculed now that are saving the country, but no one watching came away with any sense that he knew what he was talking about. And you mentioned the nicknames. And then he goes off into talking about the stock market, which apparently he no longer owns, right? When it was up, it was all about him. And now it's all about the Democrats. So he went off into this. And that was one of the things that made it so bizarre, is that he just has no sense of, okay, here's a solemn moment where I need to act as president, and he's just all over the map.
Yeah, it's a little bit like a stand-up comedian who starts riffing on something and will feed on it, but kind of in reverse. I think he threw that thing out about the stock market because he'd seen it someplace, or he wants to blame the Democrats for everything. And he said it out loud, and nobody laughed. And he thought, okay, I'm going to go with this. And all of a sudden, he owned it as a reason the stock market was crashing. Now, there's not a single person in the world who believes that the Democratic debate, as crazy as it was the other night, had anything to do with the stock market. It may have been the death of, Bloomberg's campaign, or Biden's, or Sanders, or whatever, but it had nothing to do with the stock market. But, it was like he was convincing himself. And once he convinced himself, he thought, well, if this gets on Fox News, 40% of the country will believe it. So let's go with it.
That is the reality, that he actually does have the ability to make his own informational weather, in effect. He does have it. This has now become overused about the information bubbles, but he really has created this alternative reality in which he knows that he can deflect or ignore negative information, and he can put out any line and be pretty sure that millions of people are going to be fed that particular line. This is a luxury you guys did not have. I don't think, no president has ever had until now.
No, that's exactly true. And the 2 points I'd make on that is, Roger Ailes, who started Fox News, started it, and he's, on the record in Gabe Sherman's book, saying that he started Fox News because his seminal moments in politics were in the Nixon administration. And he believed that if Nixon had had a Fox News, he wouldn't have had to resign. Bring it, all the way up to the present. Compared this, a reporter, on CNN said, is this like the mission accomplished moment? Is he declared victory too soon? And I said, I don't think it's that. I think it's more like Katrina. I think it's they realized they were in a hole, and their strategy for a couple of days was to say, no, it's not a problem. Even though we were seeing pictures every day of people like in desperate situations, and they finally figured out, okay, we have to like totally own this and fix it. And we know this is going to be a problem. And it became, I think the breaking point for the Bush popularity
right there.
The war didn't break it, but Katrina allowed people to then look at Iraq very differently, and he became an unpopular president within a matter of months.
I agree with you, but let's just go into this. So what was it about Katrina? Why was that the breaking point? I agree with you, but it's what was it that broke through everything else that was going on and made people think, okay, maybe this guy doesn't know what he's doing?
Yeah, I think it's, imagery and perceptions and emotions is what drives politics, not data. Mm-hmm. And the imagery of people, particularly people of color, suffering, starving, not being able to have water, having their lives destroyed and people dying, and the president in the most luxurious jet in the world, Air Force One, looking at it from 10, 15,000 feet, basically said, he doesn't care about us. Mm-hmm. He does not care about us. And, he had gotten away with being a conservative president by just putting the word compassionate in front of it. And at that moment, compassionate blew up. Hmm. And he just became just another conservative that, and among a lot of people, that's conservative means, you don't care about us. Again, there's two sides to every argument, but I think that's what blew it up. I think the danger for Trump is he's up there now effectively saying, this is not a problem. This is not a problem. And when it eventually gets to the place where it is a problem, it's going to be his problem. And people will say, you didn't care enough to do something about this.
You know, it really came down to three words. And I can really remember the exact moment when it happened in the Bush administration. I was doing a conservative talk show at the time. And it was obvious that things were not going well with Katrina. And the president was going down there. And I remember thinking that if President Bush got off the plane and said, you know what, this is absolutely not acceptable. Heads are going to roll. We're going to get this thing right, et cetera. You know, imagine what the trajectory would have been. Instead, we had that famous good job, Brownie moment. And as soon as he basically said, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job, you just knew that, oh, my God, this was going to just turn to shit.
Yeah, and again, it's these are qualitative moments, not quantitative moments. These are things that get to either reinforcing your positive attributes or reinforcing your negative attributes. And I think Trump is right in the middle of one of these moments where it could very much reinforce all of the negative things about him, with the only caveat, which we just talked about, is, you know, you got Fox News out there that they created an alternative reality. They'll blame Hillary Clinton for this. My words.
But at a certain point, though, being in this bubble, I mean, obviously there are tremendous advantages to that, but also the negative advantages that you constantly get the feedback, positive feedback, and you don't realize how it's actually playing to people in the real world. So speaking of bubbles, it occurs to me that back in 2016, the Republican Party, you know, absolutely lost its mind. In part because it had created this alternative reality silo. And I want to get your take on this. I don't think an alternative reality silo exists in the same way on the left or for the Democrats. But there's something familiar about what's happening right now, including the Bernie phenomenon. And there is the, you know, for a lot of us who are having these flashbacks when the Republicans lost, you know, sort of, you know, went mad. Political parties go through these fever periods. Are Democrats going through that now? It's kind of this fever of, let's, you know, after 4 years of Donald Trump, let's give the country the 78-year-old socialist who wants to double the federal budget and hand out all kinds of free stuff, and by the way, has a soft spot for folks like Fidel Castro.
Yeah, I don't, it's, there's so many, areas of comparison, but something in it doesn't completely add up. I think what it is there is a, distrust for institutions and a populism, in this country, particularly an economic populism, that the world is rigged and no one's looking out for us, that connects not Bernie with the Democratic Party, but Bernie with Trump. So I do think there is a, I don't know, 30% a part of the Democratic Party, just like right now there's a 30% at least of the Republican Party that, you know, espouses that, you know, what I think is a irrational and irresponsible populism. It's not the majority of the Democratic Party. The data just doesn't tell that story. But it is a sexier story to tell. And I think a lot of this is, you know, on all of us, who are now in the media. We immediately go to the biggest, boldest ideas as the ideas. And then we attach it to the Democratic Party. And, you know, the irony of this is those of us, I mean, I'm a moderate. I have always been. And I'm an incrementalist. I've been around long enough to know that you don't, you know, every once in a while you get this rare moment where you take a big leap and everyone's surprised. Gay marriage is the last one where you looked around and said, how did that happen so quick? Well, it didn't happen quick. It happened over 20 years of pushing. But most big things you get piece by piece. But, you know, because Bernie and to as much as it's, maybe even a larger sense, Elizabeth Warren in her heyday, was pushing these big, bold ideas that were unrealistic. You couldn't pay for them. And, you know, they just weren't going to happen. And it became sort of the litmus test with you know, reporters and even some activists of, well, if you're not going to be big and bold, then you're a status quo,
right,
you know, Hillary Clinton-like politician. And, you know, the irony is that, you know, the public option, which, you know, I've always thought is we're going to get there eventually, has become the status quo view as opposed to, you know, the current health, you know, Obamacare as it exists. So, and, you know, you couple that with most of the country being detached from the political debate and it being happening on Twitter, which is self-selected and not reflective of anything except for a bunch of crazy people who have nothing like me that have nothing better to do than spend all day, you know, telling everyone in the world what I think. And it has a, you know, it's got a distortion effect. The reality when, you know, sometimes it is worth looking at data. When you look at the data, the party is in the middle. It is a center left party. You know, I have these debates occasionally with Bernie supporters and they say something like, 64% of the country supports, you know, Medicare for all mm-hmm. with no private insurance. And then I have to say, hey, I have that poll too. And when you tell them A, B, and C, that number goes down to 29%. And guess what? That number is only Democrats. So right now, only 30% of Democrats, when they realize they're going to lose their private insurance, believe in Medicare for all. But we've spent every debate talking about almost nothing but Medicare for all. Now, whose fault is that? All of ours. I mean, you know, we haven't gotten to things that are more important, but the reality is it's why I believe Bernie can't win.
Yeah, I want to get to that because there's something feels like there's something going on, or I'm going to ask you whether something is in fact shifting because there've been a number of polls out, and of course we're going to see what happens on Saturday. But you wrote a piece for an op-ed piece, I think it was last month, making the point that Bernie Sanders had not really been vetted yet. That he wasn't facing enough scrutiny, which obviously I agree with. So, I mean, at this point, has he yet, as of today, been thoroughly vetted? Do Democrats really understand what Sanders is going to face if he is the nominee?
No. And there's a reason for that. And, you know, there's again, a lot of alchemy in politics. And this is an example. And again, I'm going to speak in general terms and paint with a broad brush. So I'm sure I'm going to offend some people here, but I don't really care.
Yeah, we do that all the time.
The media judges candidates on a sliding scale. They always have and always will. If you're Joe Biden and you're considered the front runner or someone who has a legitimate chance of winning, you're going to get scrutiny. You're going to get extra scrutiny. If you're Elizabeth Warren and you vault from the middle of the pack to the top of the pack, you are going to get the microscope. You know, some people think it's sexist. I think there is sexism involved here about how she, but the scrutiny came with the fact that she was so successful. Kamala Harris, who, you know, had a couple great moments early on, couldn't survive that scrutiny. Bernie is this weird organism in the Democratic Party. Reporters, until very recently, didn't think he could win mm-hmm. and just didn't take him seriously enough. So as he steadily rose quietly, he wasn't on cable shows every day. He's not a big presence on Twitter. You know, he just did his thing a little bit under the radar. And all of a sudden, he's the front runner and no one's taking it seriously. Now, the Bernie people will tell you this is all old news. This was vetted 2016. Well, it wasn't vetted in 2016 because no one thought he could win in 2016. He did better than people thought. But the story wasn't Bernie's strength. The story then was Hillary's weakness. Mm-hmm. And so people doubled down on Hillary's, vetting and, you know, what a bad politician she was or whatever the reason was. So no one ever, in a very serious way, took on things like his support of Castro, his support of the Soviet Union, his really weird sexist and misogynist writings from the 60s and 70s. The rape fantasies.
That he wrote when he was in his 30s.
Yes. I mean, this is not youthful inexperience. This is just, you know, midlife sickness. The fact that he is the Democrat who did more to block comprehensive immigration reform than anyone. You know, so the list goes on and on and on. And, you know, to back up this theory, and, you know, I think it's more than a theory, Biden has a 40-year record that we all know about because that's what we spent the first 6 months of this campaign talking about. And, you know, he got attacked and from all sides. Bernie, we're just hearing about his 40-year record. There's a pretty devastating Bloomberg ad out today. And this takes me to the latest piece I wrote over the weekend for CNN that basically said if Bloomberg really believes what he says, which is he thinks he'd be a great president, but number one, we've got to beat Donald Trump, that he's got to stop paying attention to anyone in the race but Bernie.
Yeah.
And today is the first, I think, big ad against that that basically shows that Bernie in 30 years has gotten three bills passed. Two of them were post offices. And then it goes through on the other side of the screen all of the pieces of legislation he wrote and introduced that failed to pass. And there are thousands of them. I mean, literally thousands of them. So, you know, he may be leading a movement, but it's a movement that hasn't done anything in 40 years. And he's not accomplished anything in 40 years. And I think that sort of stuff, and let, you know, the Democratic Party may, in its wisdom, nominate Bernie Sanders. But I want to make sure that by the time we get to the convention and the nomination, that everything that's negative about him is known. And, you know, Donald Trump doesn't, you know, unearth 50 new things. And they all should be vetted. But, you know, because of the way we structure things in our relationship with the media and the way the media covers campaigns, he just got a free ride for a very long time.
You know, he has, and I guess maybe because I come from a different point of view, I keep, you know, imagining what the lines are going to be, what the ads are going to be, how you're going to hammer him in Florida on Castro, how you're going to hammer him in Pennsylvania about the ban on fracking, the ads about $60 trillion increase in federal spending and all of those things, and how that would play in crucial Waukesha County. But here's a question I'm interested in your take on. So Elizabeth Warren was cruising along, was pressured to come up with proposals for how she was going to pay for her health care plan. She comes up with an answer, and at that moment, once she answers the question, people go, oh, okay, well, that's not going to sell. And her slide really begins from the moment that she came up with a coherent answer. And yet Bernie continues to slide because, I mean, his math doesn't even come close to adding up. And he's talking about trillions of dollars, biggest tax hike in American peacetime history, all of those things. So why did it kill Elizabeth Warren but not Bernie?
Yeah, you know, I would be remiss, and then my wife would yell at me if I didn't say that some of this is sexist. It's a different standard we hold women to. And I don't know that Warren's drop is solely related to her filling in the blanks. I think her drop was more attributable to the fact that she woke up one day, and the people around her woke up one day and said, "You know, we have to show that we can appeal to the middle too." And to the hardcore on the left, they looked at that and said, "You know, this is a purity test." And she lost support there. And if you want to trace where she fell, I don't think it has to do with her numbers. Where she fell was when she took on Bernie for the "A Woman Can't Be President" line. And the Bernie people took out after her, and it had a real impact. Now, again, this is a qualitative assessment in my own view. I can't point to a poll that says, "See, this is what tells you." But it, you know, there were a bunch of things going on there, and it's, you know, it is puzzling because she was so strong for so long. There was a point at the end of the first debate, you know, sitting around, you know, out in Detroit with a bunch of people who, you know, pretend to know about these things, where people are saying, you know, that's it. She's got it, and she's going to win. And it's, you know, why are we stressing about Joe Biden? He's lost it. And she is, she's not central to the picture right now.
No.
The other thing is, you know, and this is a slightly different point, but I want to make it because I think it's important. You know, Biden talks about how he's the most electable. And you know what? It's not because he's leading Trump in the polls. They're all leading Trump in the polls by very small margins. It's because he can offer a deep, rich contrast to Trump. you know, on his own personal integrity, his experience, the fact that he can run the government. The polls now are, you were right, I think, in alluding to the Republicans haven't had at any of these people yet. I lived through Mondale. I lived through Dukakis. I lived through Carter. I lived through John Kerry. I know what's coming. I can tell you this. Walter Mondale won one state, and the weekend after the Democratic convention in San Francisco in 1984, Newsweek came out with a poll showing Mondale ahead of Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you, coming out of the convention in 1988 with Mike Dukakis, a week after the convention, a poll showed him 17 points ahead of George Bush. And by September 15th, he was 10 points behind. So it's all nonsense that Bernie has built this coalition that is going to defeat Trump. We don't know that. And his whole theory rests on the idea that you don't need the people in the middle. I'm just going to turn out massive amounts of new voters, young people. Well, none of them have turned out yet.
Right.
We've had three contests. They don't tell us that much, but they tell us there isn't a movement yet.
I'm going to just stay with Elizabeth Warren for a moment, because she, of course, has been has directed most of her fire not at Bernie, but at Bloomberg, and she's rather obsessive about that. I don't think she was as effective in the second debate as in the first debate. She was really effective in the first debate going after Bloomberg. But it seems like she's been going out of her way not to antagonize Bernie or his bros. But in the last 24 hours, there is this viral video, which I'm sure you've seen, where she's challenged by one of the Bernie bros about whether or not the person who goes into the Milwaukee convention with a plurality should be given the nomination. And she pushes back and says, well, you know, this is the way Bernie's position in 2016 is different than his position now. The Bernie position now is, if you go in with a plurality, you know, democracy demands that you get the nomination, which was not what he was saying 4 years ago. And I'm seeing on Twitter, which of course is not real life, but is something, that it's hashtag primary Warren is trending. So the Bernie folks are really going after Warren right now. So despite all of her efforts not to break with Bernie, is something happening there?
Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of Ted Cruz and Trump back in 2016.
Yeah, it does. And the interesting thing is you know, I kind of was thinking out loud at the debate the other night, you know, why waste your time on Bloomberg? You've already killed him.
Yeah.
He's dead. I mean, he's dead for, you know, your constituents. They're never going to vote for him. And, you know, I was reminded by some friends that she raised more money in the aftermath of the Nevada debate than she had raised ever. And she can only stay alive in Super Tuesday if she gets another haul. So that was, I think, a fundraising pitch. I think it was less effective because she'd already done that. I think if she had found, she should have found something new. But you know, again, they're running their campaigns. You know, on going after Bernie, you know, the misconception I think in this campaign is that everybody fits into a lane, and it's a perfect lane. It's not. You know, I had someone recounted a conversation they'd had a couple months ago with Bernie's pollster. So I didn't get this directly, but I trust the person who told me, who's also a pollster. The Bernie's pollster said their biggest competition for votes has never been Elizabeth Warren, and it's never been Pete Buttigieg. It's Joe Biden, because they count on working class voters without a college education. Warren's biggest threat for voters is Pete Buttigieg, and you know, who is appealing to college and above. And there's a very much a class system in the Democratic Party now, which is dictated by education. So these candidates don't fit into these perfect lanes that everybody says. I mean, I know it's easy to, if you're anti-Bernie, to look at, you know, what came out of Nevada and said, well, if you add up Klobuchar, Buttigieg, and Biden, that beats Bernie. Mm-hmm. That's not how the electorate is playing out. And in fact, there was a poll out the other day that showed that if you look at Sanders voters, their number two was Bernie. And if you looked at Biden voters, their number two was Bernie.
Wow.
So there is, it's not as simple. So, and that's why I think, you know, I think that, you know, Warren would have done better to have done it politely, but gone after Buttigieg and Klobuchar and tried to eat into their votes because they're the ones who face the viability question, certainly Klobuchar first.
And urgently. Okay, so here's, yeah. I think, the most fascinating question, at least to me, the most fascinating question that I wanted to ask you about where we're at right now, particularly with some of the polls coming out showing Joe Biden doing very, very well in places like, well, South Carolina, we're going to find out. One poll showing him 20 points up, but doing very well in Florida, doing very well in Missouri. So the question is, can Joe Biden change the narrative in the next several days? Is there a shift now? Because the narrative had been, it's Bernie, Bernie's to lose. Joe Biden was on life support system. You've seen this before. Can Biden become the comeback kid? And if he is, he's going to have to do it in less than a week. Is it possible? Can it happen?
Yeah, it is possible. And it's, you know, you have a lot of things you can do in a campaign that, you know, can build momentum, sort of stop a slide or create a slide. Voters have the biggest impact. And Biden's biggest problem is he's done well in the last couple of debates. He's really improved. He's doing better on the stump. He's more energetic, all these things. But voters just hadn't, you know, voters, I guess, are lagging indicators. They weren't voting for him. South Carolina and then Super Tuesday offers the opportunity for voters to say, yeah, we love this guy. We've always loved this guy. What, you guys are all crazy. And the media will, you know, they'll do what they always do, which is, No, we never said Biden didn't have a chance. We always knew it was wait till South Carolina, even though he was ridiculed, you know, on election night in New Hampshire. Biden's problem, you know, he's got, you know, he's not a perfect candidate, so he's got a number of problems, challenges. But if you look at all of these states, there's a barrier in all of them. I mean, Tom Steyer spent almost $20 million in South Carolina. He's sitting at anywhere between 13 to 18%. Those are African-American votes. Those are Biden voters.
Right.
You know, and, you know, maybe, you know, as we get to Election Day, you've got the Jim Clyburn endorsement. You've got all the stuff that's going on. People will come home to Biden. But he's got a problem with Bloomberg in Florida. He's got a problem with somebody else in Missouri, I'm sure. And he's got to clear the field quickly, or the field has to get cleared quickly. And he's not strong enough to clear it himself. He's not strong enough to go to these people saying, look, I got 50% of the vote in this state. You got to get out. And that remains a barrier to him. And, you know, I don't see anyone being able to take advantage of that except for Bernie, who's going to consistently do well, you know, not win, but do well in all these states.
What happens if Biden wins by 20 points in South Carolina?
Well, I think, a lot of people, well, if he wins by 20 points in South Carolina, it means Bernie is well down and, you know, got drubbed. And I think it's a problem for Bernie. But the problem is you then have, what, 3 days?
Yeah.
To go to, you know, I think it's 40% of the delegates. And remember, in a lot of these states, particularly California, millions of people have already voted. You know, they're not going to feel the Joe-mentum or whatever stupid name Biden's people come up with it. So it is really going to be a mixed bag, I think, on Super Tuesday. I think the thing to look for is who comes out of that day with the narrative of, you know, I have a path here. I have a path not to, you know, win a brokered convention, but I have a path to get, you know, to the 1900 level. You know, and I could see Bernie being able to do that, and I can see Biden being able to do that. At this point, it's very hard to see Bloomberg being able to do that, or any of the other candidates.
So, what are the prospects, though, of this not being decided by Milwaukee?
Well, you know, we have this conversation every 4 years, yeah. And every 4 years I say this is ridiculous. It's as silly as the conversation that the VP pick matters. You know, beyond 2 days, but I don't, you know, maybe it's not so silly this time. You know, normally I'm leading the choir saying this is just, you know, it's a media self-obsession with we'll get better ratings at the convention if it's brokered. There is a possibility of that happening. And then the, you know, the super delegates will all of a sudden have, you know, will have a decisive, a position. It will make for a much more interesting story. I don't think that it's going to hurt the Democrats, though.
Okay, that was my next question, yeah. Is whether the Democrats could survive a convention like that.
Yeah, I normally would say it would be a terrible problem for the Democrats. Here's why I don't think it is. One is there's massive amounts of institutional organizing going on, taking advantage of Democrats and moderates' hatred of Donald Trump. That's going on. And it's going on separate from the nomination process. And it's pretty well funded. And Bloomberg makes a big difference here. You know, the ability to put ungodly amounts of money in so that you're not outspent and that there's money to do all these things. The Trump hatred is never going to dissipate among Democrats. You know, it's only going to get worse, trust me, with, you know, just Trump being Trump. So the party's ready, and the party has been ready for a long time to try to crush Trump, you know, at the ballot box and politically. They just haven't been able to find their vehicle yet. I think there's a weird chance that even if we go to going to a contested convention where there's drama, where we don't know who's going to win, and, you know, all of a sudden we're back in 1968, but it's in a made-for-television moment, and someone emerges out of, you know, from the as the phoenix from the ashes, that will create tremendous excitement.
That's otherwise a hell of a story.
Otherwise, the convention's a snooze that the networks aren't even going to cover. I mean, we know that. They're going to give it an hour this night and an hour that night. So basically, it's an address to the nation. You don't get any of
the... They've been infomercials. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, this will actually be a made-for-TV moment of real politics.
By the way,
So who knows?
As an indication of how old I am, I was actually at this 1968 convention. I was a page. You know, Jim Swift is looking at me like old guy story. No, I was actually a page to the Wisconsin delegation in Chicago. So I remember that. And of course, I live in Milwaukee. Okay, so Joe, here's an interesting thing. I get off. I actually flew in from Milwaukee this morning to D.C. And a guy comes running up to me at the airport, and he's a progressive activist. Somebody who wouldn't be close to me in a different life, you know, and he said, you know, what is going on? What do you think is going to happen? You know, are they really going to nominate Bernie Sanders? And he said, you know, I don't know why they keep referring to it as a brokered convention. Why don't they start referring to it as a consensus convention? That we're looking for consensus. Get rid of the brokered. And I thought, you know, language matters, right? Words do matter, and consensus convention sounds a lot better than brokered convention, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, call it the people's convention, where actually, you know, the delegates get to decide, because they're not, you know, all of a sudden they can vote their conscience rather than, you know, who they're pledged to. I think that's exactly right. Because the misnomer in all of this is that there's a broker left.
Right.
You know, when I get attacked as an establishment Democrat, I look around and say, establishment was my dad, not me. I mean, there is no party anymore. It is, you know, it's you need to have the two political parties to run the convention and set the rules for how you get the nomination. That's about it right now. You know, the Republican Party, as you know better than I, has become a cult, or it's been taken over by a cult leader. I don't want to say that everyone who supports Donald Trump is a member of a cult. They're not, but that's the feeling there. Democrats, you know, it's a loose association where most of the party functions were outsourced within the last 8 years. I mean, that's one of the results of the Obama administration, that he looked at the party and said, you can't do what I need. I'm going to do it myself. Mm-hmm. And he built Obama for America. And there's all these different groups now doing the voter file and doing the organizing and all of that stuff. So there is no establishment anymore. There is an ideological division in the party. There's Bernie Sanders and the squad that represent a minority of the party, and then there's the rest of the party. The far left gets disproportionately more coverage and attention than the middle, but so be it. That's just the way it is. And I think, you know, whoever this guy who ran into you was pretty smart, because there's anything that suggests that a backroom deal will decide our nominee is bad for the party, is bad for Democrats. But I have to tell you, having worked directly in 5 presidential campaigns and informally in 2 others, there is no backroom.
Yeah.
If you're looking for the room where it happens, keep looking. There just isn't a place right now. It is a roving party that if you happen to be in the right place at the right time, you just might have an impact.
At the right place at the right time, could Barack Obama be that broker? Could he be, play a role? Are there, as you point out, no brokers?
Yeah, I mean, if there is one person with outsized influence, I'd say it is Obama, but he has to be so careful not to play the card too soon.
Yeah.
He can only play it once. He can't be the head of the Stop Bernie movement because the party may need him at a critical moment. And so for all the people criticizing, and it's, I always find that, there is a reversal of roles from the last time. I was one of the cheerleaders for telling the Republicans, you're crazy, stop doing this. Mm-hmm. Because I really want you to do it because we knew we could beat Trump, which was wrong. But there's kind of an ethos of being in the Democratic Party for your lifetime or being in the Republican Party that you can't explain to the other side. So, with all due respect to you and to mm-hmm. Bill Kristol and Jennifer Rubin, when they say, here's what the Democrats should do, I'm like, guys, you don't even have the first clue about how screwed up we are.
There's so much dysfunction.
And the other is true, too. I mean, I'll say to my Republican mm-hmm. friends, why, you should have done this. And they're like, there's like seven reasons why we don't do that. None of them make sense, but if you were in the family, you'd know it.
Yeah.
It's fun to prescribe, the medication for the other party. It's a lot harder when you're in your own. And again, there isn't an organizing principle around it anymore. You can't go to a strong DNC or RNC chair. You can go to Pelosi and she has a lot of power. And Chuck Schumer has some power and the candidates have enormous power. Getting back to Obama, I think we may have a moment very late in the process where he gets to put his thumb on the scale, but he's absolutely right to keep his powder dry until it has the maximum impact because otherwise, he just can't do it twice.
Joe Lockhart. Thank you so much for spending so much time with us on today's Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it very much.
Happy to do it.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. We'll do this all over again.